come from one of the philosophers in the area who has been closely interested in philosophy and physics for a long time. He's also very interested in the methodology of science. He has several books on philosophy of physics and philosophy of science in general. He's giving a public lecture this evening on the role of visualization in science and mathematics. And we're very happy to have him here today to tell us how to move forward tonight. Some of us are in duty of philosophical discussion.
Thank you, Dee, very much. It's an enormous pleasure to be here. And what I'm going to do is talk about thought experiments, more or less in general, and give you my take on how they work. Everybody loves thought experiments. I'll give you a lot of examples. You probably know most of these examples. But the real guts of any talk on thought experiments is how you actually classify them and how you think that they work. As I say, everybody loves thought experiments, but there's remarkably little that's actually written explicitly on the topic. When I got interested in the subject a few years ago, I went searching, you know, for literature, thinking there'd be, you know, zillions of articles, and so I read it all through it. And I found that at the time, I don't think there were more than six or seven articles in the entire history of the universe explicitly written on the topic of thought experiments in the sciences. Ernst Mach had written some stuff, and that's really interesting and important. And there's one or two articles by a couple of historians, and that was virtually it. After I'd written two or three papers, I almost doubled the literature by myself on the topic. So anyway, I have a view about how thought experiments work. It's a little cranky. You'll probably disagree with it. That's OK. But the challenge will be to come up with something a little bit better. It's not easy. So let me begin. As I say, there'll be a lot of examples that you probably know. But it's always fun to just look at them and think about them. Almost 2,000 years ago, this is a very old one, but it's a real gem. About 2,000 years ago, Lucretius, in his wonderful poem called The Nature of Things, gives an argument. It's a thought experiment. He gives an argument for the infinity of space. It's very simple. It's a beautiful little thought experiment. He says, you just imagine this is the alleged edge of the universe, okay? So you throw a spear at it. Either the spear goes through the alleged edge, in which case it wasn't the edge, or it bounces back. If it bounces back, there's something made it bounce back, in which case there's something beyond the edge of the universe that did it. Okay? So either way, you're not going to get to the edge of the universe. Therefore, you know, space is infinite. That was the argument. It's a very simple argument. And it's pretty typical of thought experiments in general. So what happens? You imagine some situation. Okay? You visualize it in your mind. You carry out some operation, and you see what happens. You just sort of look, as it were, and you see what happens in the thought experiment. And they're called thought experiments probably because they're experiential. You're seeing stuff. Okay? It's not just some hypothetical case where you imagine such and such, and then you do a calculation. It is something experiential, something observable about it. And as with a real experiment, a number of different things can be involved. So there's observation for sure. There may be some calculation involved. There may be some conjecturing involved. There may be some application of some existing theory involved. Okay? Just as if you were doing a real experiment. There's no neat and clean boundary between what you literally see and all of the other stuff that you bring to it. Okay? Now, some of these thought experiments actually do correspond to real experiments. That is, you can carry them out in reality just as you do in your mind, as it were. But a lot of them don't. I don't think actually that's an important distinction, though some people do. The other thing about thought experiments is that they're just like real experiments, they're fallible. They're not going to give you a guarantee at all. Just like real experiments, they need to be interpreted, they can make all kinds of mistakes, relation mistakes. Mistakes in observation, talking, conceptualize it the wrong way, and so on. In the case of the Lucretius, infinitude of space, well, you're all theoretical physicists, so you see a problem right away, and that is that he can only conceive, that's the only thing that he's bringing to the thought experiment, is a kind of Euclidean space, right? I mean, as soon as you imagine, you know, a different topology, suppose you're a bug on a sphere, and you're throwing your little lance, okay, you're going to keep working around the sphere, and never hit a boundary, and yet you're still in a finite universe. So these are kinds of conceptualizations that might only occur to you later. And because of that, these thought experiments are often, well, they're always valid, often wrong. Okay, now I want to begin by giving you some examples and sort of illustrating a kind of taxonomy of thought experiments. They're not all the same. They work often in very, very different ways. Okay? So these examples, which you probably know most of them, but I don't need to explain them in length. But they're here mainly for the purposes of illustrating the taxonomy. Now, one big class of thought experiments seems to me to be wholly destructive. The aim of the thought experiment is to destroy some existing theory. So you take so-and-so's theory, you run through a thought experiment, and you say, aha, see? This gives you an absurd answer. The theory is all screwed up. And that, I think, is probably what's happening in the case of young Einstein when he's chasing the light beam. Okay, so you probably all know this one. He imagines himself running very fast and catching up to a wave film. Okay? And he says, now what would it look like? Now, this is the nice thing about thought experiments. Don't ask yourself, well, how does he see, the light that have little photons coming from the photons, as it were. Okay. You just sort of suppress that kind of consideration for the thought experiment. And you ask yourself, what kind of weird wave theory makes of time in the thought experiment? Just ask yourself, what would the wave look like now that you've caught up to it? And for an analogy, you can sort of imagine yourself out of a pier. And the waves are coming in and running down the pier, keeping time with the wave. So what do you actually see? You see a hump in the water, okay? And the hump is at rest with respect to you. The hump is just there, and you're moving along together like this. It's a very natural and intuitive way to consider it. But as soon as you actually think of the details of Maxwell's electrodynamics, this will immediately collapse. And that's because, in order to get an electric field, you need a changing. Not a magnetic field, but a changing magnetic field. In order to get a magnetic field, you need a changing electric field. But you're actually, by hypothesis of the thought experiment, this is supposed to be stationary. So it's not a changing magnetic field, it's not a changing electric field. And the whole thing is just going to collapse on you. So the theory actually will not allow Einstein to catch up and run along beside a light field. Okay? It falls apart. All right. But it's not telling what the truth is. But it does. It creates havoc for Maxwell's theory, at least in the form in the late 19th century, free relativity. Here's another thought experiment, which is also destructive. Schrodinger's cat. Now you all know how this goes. So. Here for Bohr, you've got a state of superposition of something like a radioactive atom, and you describe this as a little vector, superposition in Hilbert space. It's not in one of the eigenstates. After some time has elapsed, it's not in one of the eigenstates. What's happening? And of course, it's very weird at a micro level. And Schrodinger said, look, just to show you how damn weird it is at the micro level, I'm going to set up the cat thought experiment to amplify that weirdness into the larger macro world. And so the cat's in there, and through a chain, okay, you create the tensor product of all these devices, the atom, the Geiger counter that's going to detect it with it decays, the hammer that's going to react to the Geiger counter, okay, and you've got a superposition of smashing into the poison or not smashing into the poison, tensor product of that with the cat living, the cat dead, And it's a totally weird thing. So everything that's weird at the micro level gets amplified into the macro level until you look, okay? And then you put it into an eigenstate of whether you want to get attacked. Now, how does the Fox family work? Well, I mean, how is it supposed to work? Well, what it is it's not really like the first one, where there's a logical problem for classical electrodynamics. Okay. At least classical electrodynamics wedded to Galilean relativity. The problem here is the tension between very robust common sense views about what reality has to be. And if you could stomach them at a micro level, well, good for you. But you shouldn't be able to stomach them at the macroscopic pathway. And so the theory sort of gets refuted in that kind of way. Now, it's destructive because it's supposed to destroy Copenhagen interpretation. But notice that it's coming sort of out from the outside. That is, you bring in powerful common sense beliefs about how cats behave. And in the case of the Einstein chasing the light beam, it was more internal. It's more like an internal logical contradiction. There's no logical contradiction here. It's just grossly absurd. That's the motivation.
What's the problem with the Copenhagen distribution?
I don't want to argue that issue. I just wanted to tell you how Schrodinger understood his thought experiment and how it was supposed to work. Okay, so he's the test board. Doesn't believe that observation or measuring instruments or whatever put the world, the micro world, into eigenstates. Okay? And just to show you how absurd it is, he'll amplify that problem of superpositions in the micro world, in the atom, right up into the full-scale object that you're regularly familiar with, namely a cat. Okay? And then the intuition is, that's absurd. You're supposed to think that's absurd, and therefore it's absurd even in the micro world. Sorry, is that answering your question?
I don't see what I'm measuring. You mentioned the problem with measuring. This has nothing to do with the measurement. It's just the amplification of the fact that there's a very small system of superpositions and you make a big line.
Yeah, it's bizarre without the measurement. All by itself, it's bizarre. If you want to make it more bizarre, then the cat goes into the knifing state of living or dead upon observation. That just makes it even worse. Okay? And there's all sorts of things that you could reply to this. I mean, someone like Bohr, who believed in a sharp distinction between the micro world and the macro world, and thought that the macro world was classical. It's not just some one approximation, it's classical. Then the thought experiment doesn't even work. You just draw a line, between the radioactive atom and all of the other stuff that you say. The atoms in superposition will never look at. There's all kinds of responses you can make to this. And of course, if you know some other people, von Neumann and Wigner, actually accept that the cat does go into the state of superposition until you, with your consciousness, actually come along and observe it. Okay? So, Fox experiments are completely fallible. It's open to all kinds of interpretation of the data. Now, there's another class of thought experiments which don't do any work for the theory itself. They have more a kind of pedagogical role, but it's an extremely important pedagogical role. And I call this class mediative thought experience. One of my favorite examples of this, maybe it's one of my favorites because of childhood, very fond childhood memory, but it's Newton's diagram of a cannon firing cannonballs. Okay, so the idea is, what's going on with the moon? The moon, the apple falling out of the tree, or the moon being in orbit, they're really two instances of the same phenomenon. And I certainly remember as a child, and maybe you do too, that seemed to be absurd. Something else is going on, I don't know what, not that. And then when I saw a diagram inspired by Newton's diagram, then all of a sudden it was just bang, oh, now I get it. It was just that wonderful aha effect. And this, it seems to me, is just a perfect illustration of that. Okay, so you've got a cannon on the mountain firing cannonballs. Put more powder in, okay, and keep firing, and you see it keeps going further and further. And the falling away of the earth, okay, is relevant here. And eventually, if you put enough powder in, give it enough initial velocity, it'll actually come around to where it started. So if you want to know what keeps the moving arc around the earth, there it is. You don't need a calculation for this. You don't need to understand the universe and gravitation yet. Some sort of vague idea. But this actually gives it to you. You suddenly have what Kuhn might call a gestalt switch. Stop seeing it as a duck, and we start seeing it as a rabbit. Once you see this thought experiment like this. I'm inclined to think Maxwell's demon plays this sort of a role. Now, you know Maxwell's demon, where you've got a hot body and a cold body, and the demon is there opening the door, letting fast molecules from the cold gas into the box of the hot gas, and slow molecules from the hot gas into the cold gas, and thereby making the cold gas colder and the hot gas hotter, even though they're in contact. Right? It's a violation of the second law. All right, now what's the point of the thought experiment? I think that, now this is an interesting historical question. I think you have to understand Maxwell in the context of his day. When statistical thermodynamics is really brand new, nobody's thinking like that. You all think like that now, but nobody thought like that in his day. And I'm inclined to think that the point of the demon experiment is actually pedagogical. It's, you're having a hell of a lot of trouble understanding how the world could violate the second law of thermodynamics when you've been indoctrinated in the classical version of it. I'm going to tell you how it's even remotely possible, okay? And it sort of teaches you that kind of lesson. And so now you can see, well, yeah. And even though the statistical version of the second law makes violations of entropy, incredibly little, okay, we're not going to experience in our lifetime. It doesn't have to be this properly. The cream and the coffee isn't going to suddenly separate for any of us here. But it's even more than that. It's sort of how is the only thing that something like that can happen. Now, most discussions today of Maxwell's demon are performed, doesn't the demon actually violate, or have to expend energy in order to do this, and isn't the second law actually preserved after all? That's an interesting question, but I think it's probably not what Maxwell himself was interested in doing when he actually created the thought experiment. I think it was much more of a kind of pedagogical process. One of the most famous thought experiments in the entire history of physics is the first thought to be Newton's body. It's a fine example of an experiment which is both a thought experiment and a real experiment, because you can do it at home, reasoning yourself. And you know how it goes. So you imagine an otherwise empty universe with a bucket of water in it, and you don't ask what the cord is attached to. And you don't ask what's holding the water down in the bucket. Suspend. This is a theatrical people say, this is the willing suspension of disbelief. Okay? And you let the bucket go, and the ropes all twisted and coiled up, okay? You let the bucket go. And in the first case, everything's at rest with respect to everything else. The water is at rest with respect to the bucket. In case two, the water and the bucket are actually in relative motion. Okay, so the bucket's going this way, the water's going that way. Okay, they're moving relative to one another. In the third case, they're back at rest with respect to one another. Okay. The water and the bucket are not moving with respect to one another. Now you've got this interesting question. What's the difference between state one and state three? How do you explain the difference? And then, of course, Newton's answer is absolute space. In the third case, the bucket is really rotating. It's rotating with respect to space itself, even though there's nothing else in space. Now Newton actually can imagine, as if any of you teach this example, your students meet the test room and say, yeah, yeah, what about gravity, what we water down, and what do you got the bucket attached to, and so on. So Newton's actual example is just a couple of spheres with a cord between them. And he says, now imagine that these spheres don't attract or repel one another, the materials that don't attract or repel. But there's a lot of tension in the cord. Okay? Now that tension should pull the spheres together, but they don't pull them together. There's tension there, and there's no explanation for it of your in the materials themselves. How do you explain the persistence of the tension? Answer. The whole thing is rotating in space itself. Okay? It's inertia. Okay? Space itself is the home, the source of inertia. And that's what's keeping the spheres apart and putting the tension into the core. Okay? So what does the thought experiment do? The thought experiment itself actually is mainly the establishment of the phenomena. The phenomenon, I should say. The phenomenon being the two spheres with the cord and the tension between them. That's the observable part. And then you've got a problem. Okay, that's sort of the experimental part. And then there's the sort of theoretical part. What's doing it? And Newton's answer is absolute space. The whole thing is rotating in space itself. Now it's interesting how people responded to the thought experiment because Berkeley and Mach actually did not challenge the explanation. They didn't say absolute space is a bad explanation of the tension in the core. What they said was, if you had an otherwise empty universe, there wouldn't be any tension in the core. They actually challenged the phenomena that was the central part of the thought experiment. And so it's an interesting reaction to it. Okay? Oh, I call it conjectural because, in a sense, it's doubly conjectural. The phenomenon is being conjectured. I mean, Newton just thought, just took it for granted that that's how it would be. But really, it's actually being conjectured when you see that how some people reacted to it. And then, of course, there's the conjecture that absolute space is conjectured as the explanation of the phenomenon. Now, there's a class of thought experiments that I like to call direct. They get right to a glorious conclusion that's interesting and important. The Lucretius thought experiment for absolute space, where I gave you at the beginning, I think it's fun in this class. Einstein's elevator, I think, you know, where you get light bending in the elevator. Okay, I think that's probably in this class. But one of my favorite examples is from Simon Stevin in the beginning of the scientific revolution. Now I should, you know the answer, but when I give this example to my philosophy students, I hide it right aside, and then I ask them to check your intuitions about this. Okay, so what Stevin's interested in, and he's worried about statics, okay? The behavior of bodies and body inclined planes and that sort of thing. And so what we have here is a double frictionless plane, okay? Frictionless on both sides. And we have a chain draped over it, and those are supposed to be linked together. Now the question is, what's going to happen to the chain? We drape it over, what's going to happen? And then I actually ask my audience, you're bad on this desk if you all know the answer. If you don't know the answer, you should keep your shape, right? But I presume you all know the answer. But I asked my audience, well, what, which way do you think it's going to go? Look, there's more weight on the left side, so maybe it'll go that way. On the other hand, it's a much steeper incline on the right, so maybe it'll go that way. Have a little show of hands. And who thinks it's going to stay static? And my class is usually divided into three. This will be people without a physics education. So it's interesting what people's intuitions are. But the reaction, as soon as they see the right-hand side, is glorious. Everybody gets it anyway. It's just such a gift. What you've done, what Stevin has done, is add extra links on the bottom, and it's notice that it's perfectly symmetrical. If a link were to come down, like if it were to tip over, if it were to tip this way, then a link would come down here, and one would go up here, leaving the bottom exactly the same.
Okay.
And same, of course, from the other way. So immediately you see what would happen if it moved to fall. What did you got? You got a perpetual motion machine. Now, he brings that as an extra assumption. That's a background piece of information for the example. So as long as you believe there's no perpetual motion machines, then this has to be static. You can't move to the left or to the right. You're looking perfectly frictionless. Notice that it's essentially a thought experiment, because it's done with a real frictionless plane. Okay? It's totally frictionless, something you're never going to realize in a real laboratory. And yet it's a stunning, wonderful result. This is on these great studies. I am completely lost track of the time. No, actually, I don't know. How long are we for fun? I mean, how much time do we have total?
Yeah.
1 hour total. I better speed up.
One hour, we typically go a little bit longer when they're first.
Oh, okay.
Yep.
Yeah. Now, I won't spend any time on this. I'll just tell you there's an awful lot of really interesting thought experiments. These are the kind that the philosophers actually spend an awful lot of time themselves with. These are thought experiments in physics with a big chunk of philosophical content in them. And I thought I'd just mention, I won't go into them at all, but I'll just mention three, and very quickly. One is Heisenberg's famous gamma ray microscope, which then went on to, which he used to establish the uncertainty principle. Another one is Poincaré's disk swirl. He imagines little bugs on a disk, and as they move around on the disk with their measuring rods, the rods expand and contract in a very uniform way. And as they lay down their measuring rods, starting from the center, it actually takes infinitely many to get to the edge because of the contraction. So they reasonably come to the view that we live in an infinite universe. But we, you know, seemingly better than our universe, we say, no, it's a very finite universe, and it's got this peculiar fact about measuring rods and so on. And he draws conclusions about the conventionality of geometry, because he says, look, we could be in a very similar situation, and we have no way of telling whether our measuring rods are actually affected by movement around them. And we actually have to make a conventional decision about that. Einstein's, at the very beginning of the paper on general relativity, there Einstein has this philosophical discussion. He says, imagine two spheres. One is an actual sphere, and the other one is an ellipsoid of revolution. Okay? And he says, now they're made of the same materials, okay, and they're rotating with respect to one another. What's the explanation for the shapes of these? And then, of course, you know exactly what Newton would say. Well, the ellipsoid is actually really rotating, and the sphere is stationary. It's not rotating in absolute space. And Einstein says, well, this is a load of crap. It can't work like that. I can't remember the exact terminology. It's something like this. There's an epistemological defect in this line of reasoning. And then he pays homage to Locke and so on. These three thought experiments actually all have something in common, and it's a philosophical principle known as verificationism. And the principle, the version of it, goes roughly something like this: a proposition P is true or false, it has some truth value, exactly when it can be empirically confirmed or refuted. Otherwise, it's actually meaningless. Okay? There's no such thing as ignorance in principle. We can know everything in principle. What we can't know in principle is not even a fact to be learned. Okay? And this sort of principle is actually highly
well, it's pretty explicit in Einstein. It's hidden in Heisenberg. It's sort of vaguely there in Poincaré. But I mean, it just shows you how some thought experiments work. They're not just dealing with the physical world, but they incorporate a lot of extra assumptions that are coming from all over the place, even from yes, in fact, that's the what you yes, well, maybe yes. Right? I mean, that's certainly one way of actually characterizing some of the central debates in over the interpretation of quantum mechanics. So half the world says, right, the theory is complete, there's nothing there. Right? If you've got, say, a position measurement in the X direction, there is no momentum in the X direction. And you know everything there is to know. Even an omniscient God would know something in addition. Okay. And if you don't like that, if you're a typical realist, I won't say everybody else, but a typical realist, you say, no, I know what the position is, I don't know what the momentum is, but there is a momentum. Okay? Sometimes, I don't know, it's not deep, it's not a deeply entrenched terminology, but the difference is nicely captured between calling the Heisenberg principle the uncertain principle, which suggests ignorance, versus the indeterminacy principle, which suggests there isn't even anything there. Okay? Some people use those two phrases that way. But anyway, I mean, it's open to debate. But it's the same issue. Just as an aside, I never like to when I've got a captive audience, I never like to miss this question. Why does chemistry have no thought experiments? I think this is totally bizarre. Every time I meet a chemist, I ask. And every time I meet an historian of chemistry, I ask. And the answer is the same. I don't know. I'm just learning. They can't give me examples, and they can't explain why.
It is easy to perform experiments in chemistry.
I don't know. Maybe it's just a kind of a cultural thing. Physicists are used to thought experiments and chemists aren't. You know, maybe it's just one of those.
Are you sure they aren't there? I mean, if I say, what would it take to blow up this building, I'm probably not going to do it.
No, I think that's just a I don't think that's a thought experiment. I have had actually people giving me the following reply, which is borderline, I admit. They say, there are lots of thought experiments. Chemists all the time visualize putting molecules together, okay? And then they can sort of see what would happen, you know, if they did that. And I don't know whether that's a thought experiment or not. I can't really quite decide.
But I'd
like a nice clean cut example. I've never found one.
Are there thought experiments with regard to the origin of life, which is a chemical thought experiment?
I don't want to give a sharp definition of thought experiments. In thought experiments, I want it to be kind of visualizable, experiential, in some important stuff. And there's a whole lot of stuff that is hypothetical. Like, let's imagine we mix chemical X with chemical Y, and you do some computations, and say, oh, this is what could happen. I don't think that's a thought experiment. That's just a kind of calculation, a derivation from the theory. No, I want, it's got to be, in some sense, experiential. Yes?
I think a lot of thought experiments and a lot of physics in our minds relate to accessing our notions of the continuum.
Yeah.
Whereas chemistry, I think it's lacking. I mean, even if you look at quantum mechanics as a chemistry, I mean, maybe you should deal with the eigenstates. We don't think about the continuum of pure states as a mechanism for explaining. Whereas in physics, all of us, throughout time, we've employed the natural notion of the continuum to explain a lot of things. And of course, you know, space and time, and now quantum theory too, as a continuum of pure states, that's for using that ability.
That's interesting. That might actually go some way to explain it. They can't go all the way because there's a lot of physics thought experiments which don't involve
continuum in any interesting or important sense. So it's not as if it has to be a Fox movie. Okay, well, anyway, that's just a kind of aside, but have any of you actually think of an example? I'd love to actually hear about it, even if it's next week in an email.
From the college, squares that Einstein knows how much time is in the next song in the sphere.
Yeah.
Five principles, which is a simple solution. Einstein is good for the internet.
Oh yeah, yeah. I think the discussion, Einstein's discussion is just bad. It's wrong. It's all wrong. The verification is wrong. That's a lot of stuff is wrong. Yeah. But it was. I think it was probably a very important thought experiment for him, motivating a lot of the work. At least at that time in general relativity. Yeah. Okay, now back to the main story. All right, now I'm going to show you the world's greatest thought experiment. This is my favorite, and I still remember the day I heard about it. I fell out of my chair. I thought it was the most wonderful thing I'd ever heard in my life. And I was an undergraduate philosophy student, and if any of you were undergraduate philosophy students, and took intro philosophy, what you almost certainly studied was a little bit of Descartes, a little bit of Hume. Right? Does this ring a bell with some of you? And Descartes is your classic rationalist, and he believes that you can actually learn about nature just by thinking. Hume is your classic empiricist who says, no, all knowledge comes through the senses, anything else is just a fantasy. And I thought, wow, Descartes and Plato and so on, they're my guys. Of course, that's crazy. Unfortunately, Hume is right. And then along came this, and it changed my view completely, and I've been back in the so-called rationalist camp ever since. So here's the thought experiment. It comes from Galileo, it's in the Discorsi, and he's talking about free fall with the representative of Aristotle, Simplicio, and the Aristotelian theory, which by the way is also common sense. Okay? Says that heavy bodies fall faster than light bodies. From which it immediately follows that if you stick a heavy body, a cannonball, and paste it to a light body, a musket ball, you get an even heavier body than the cannonball alone. So it's got to fall faster than a single cannonball. The joint object will fall faster than the heavy object. But of course, it also, by a perfectly reasonable chain of argument, it'll work the opposite way. Because look, you've got this heavy cannonball struggling to go down fast, and you've got this little light musket ball pasted to it, acting like a little parachute, slowing it down on the leg. So it's actually going to go at some intermediate speed. And in particular, it's going to go slower than the cannonball all by itself. This is absurd. I do have a contradiction. Right? This is absurd. But it's dead easy to resolve the problem. You just make everything fall at the same speed. There it is. It's wonderful. What did Galileo think of this? He thought it was wonderful too. But there are lots of passages in Galileo's work where he says, how the hell with the real experience? I know what's going to happen. I just thought of that. I don't have to go and climb up the damn meeting tower and piece it. I can just do it in my head. It's a lot faster, it's cleaner, it's more economical. Okay? Now, the thought experiments like this are very rare. Okay? But they actually, going back to my little taxonomy, they're simultaneously in two camps. Okay? They're destructive. I mean, you know, Aristotle's view is just destroyed, point of view is certain. And then the resolution just falls out of it so naturally that I want to call it constructive too. Okay? So it's simultaneously a destructive philosophy and a constructive philosophy. Now, this is where I'm going to lose you. Like Galileo, I think this actually provides you a priori knowledge of nature. A priori, let me quickly assert that a priori does not mean certain. A priori just means independent of the senses. It's not sensory information. So you have a different kind of access to how the world works. Okay? Now, why? Very, very quickly. There's no new empirical input in this space. Okay? We have that new empirical information. It's not a logical truth. Bodies don't have to fall at the same rate. Red bodies could fall faster than blue bodies. If that were the theory, that you couldn't run this little thought experiment on it, because you can't take two red bodies and get a red body. Okay? So it's not going to work like that. And also, you remember a few years ago the fifth force? We all forgot the fifth force. The fifth force was a couple of American physicists introduced it because they were trying to make sense of the Etwash data. And they thought you actually had to introduce an extra force that sort of played a role in gravitational phenomena. And, well, basically the idea is this, that it's not mass alone, but mass and chemical composition matters in rates of fall. Okay? So, I mean, that could be the truth. I mean, you know, the world could have been, logically speaking, the world could have been like that. And if that were the case, you can't just, you know, start pasting balls together and get the same kind of reductive adversary as you do with weights. Okay. Now, and also, Galileo isn't just some sort of trivial modification. It's something really new. All right. And finally, and I'm going to argue for this in a minute, it fits in very, very nicely with two other cranky views that I called, one about math and one about the laws of nature, which I'll now tell you. Okay, so the question is, how is this even possible that you can have a priori knowledge of nature? Okay, now, very, very, very quick word about mathematical Platonism. If you talk to ordinary working mathematicians, a huge chunk of them are Platonists. So that's fine. When you move outside of math circles, people become a little more worried about Platonists. But I'm just going to dogmatically assert that Platonism is the case. I won't argue for that, I'll just assert it. And here's what I mean. That mathematical objects exist independently from us and outside of space and time. They're abstract entities. Okay? That's one. And the second thing is that we can actually see or somehow or other grasp. We have intuitions of mathematical objects. Okay? So those are the two ingredients in Platonism. My hero on this matter is Pyrrho, who was a very staunch Platonist. Here's a nice quote. Despite their remoteness from sense experience, we do have something like a perception also of the objects of set theory, as is seen from the fact that the axioms force themselves upon us as being true. I don't see any reason why we should have any less confidence in this kind of perception, i.e., in mathematical intuition, than in sense perception, which induces us to build up physical theories and to expect that future sense perceptions will agree with them. Okay? Now, the main upshot that I want to take away from this is that we have the capacity to somehow or other see or grasp abstract things. Okay? That's the first thing. Yeah.
I see that, but how does that square with the example of the rotating bucket? Isn't this somehow outside that? Because you can refute the basic experiment. It wouldn't be like
the rotating bucket isn't an example of one of my Platonic thought experiments. I wouldn't take that to be an example. I think there are remarkably few examples that fit the pattern that I'm now arguing for. Okay? In fact, as far as I can tell, the thought experiment has to be simultaneously destructive and constructive. Okay? And that's exceedingly rare among thought experiments. Yeah. But that particular example, I wouldn't worry. Okay.
We are addressed
human beings, Well, they could, but they'd be wrong unless they agree. Well, no, they might be right and we might be wrong. But it's like perception in general. I mean, there's stuff there, and your perception could be screwed up. You might have illusions, and not see things correctly, but there's something there. Remember, as I've been stressing right from the start, this is a fallible business. I'm not claiming, the certainty of any sort. So it's like an ordinary perception. We have misperceptions of senses. And just because you sometimes make mistakes, okay, that you wouldn't say, oh, never trust my eyes again. Right? Okay, now, this is a peculiar, this topic is peculiar to philosophy. And so let me just give you a quick word or two about it. Yeah?
How does this
play into
that
vision and vision? Oh, I'm good. I'm getting to that. So I need first. So I made this claim about thought experiments giving some thought experiments giving us a priori knowledge of nature. Now I want to make that fit with two other things. One is mathematical Platonism, and the conclusion that I wanted you to get out of mathematical Platonism, and I admit I'm completely going at it and really asserting it. The thing I want you to take away from it is that it's possible to see abstract entities. Okay? That's part. Okay, that's making a big assumption.
Yeah,
I won't try to play. Okay. All right. Now, the second thing, now this is very quick. This will probably be unfamiliar except to the philosophers in the audience who will disagree also. So I should tell you this is not standard stuff. Okay, the perennial philosophical problem is what is the law of nature? Not particular laws, but just what kind of thing is it? And the most famous answer was given by David Hume, the arch empiricist, and he said it's a regularity that we expect. So, for instance, and I'll use a bad example, but it's an intuitive example. All ravens are black. Okay? That's a law of nature. Why? Because every single raven is black. And we've had lots of experience of ravens, so much so that if I tell you, I have a raven behind my back, what color do you think it is, you have this very strong disposition to believe it's black. Okay? So what a law is, a law of nature, is a regularity that we've come to believe. It's a very subjective view.
Yeah. It's not actually a definition of something, because it's a little white right and it's close.
No, I don't want to trivialize it that way.
It's in fact,
matter
of fact, it's false. There are a lot of relationships.
Yeah, that's right. It's a bad example. It's a bad example as a law, because all sorts of things could happen in ravens to change color, like if it was an ice age or something like that, they probably turn white. But I just forget the example, don't take the example too seriously, just as a simple illustration. Okay, now the trouble with views like that is that it has enormous difficulty distinguishing what we intuitively think of as laws from accidents. For instance, this is also a regularity. Everybody in this room is wearing socks. If it's not, get the hell out. Everybody in this room is wearing socks, and it's the sort of thing we actually expect. It's not a law of nature, right? And it's very, very difficult for people like you and Hume's followers to distinguish the things that seem like real laws from things that just seem like accidental generalizations. But he's not here, is he? and imagine that the building blew up tomorrow. Okay? So that in the entire history of this room, every human being who ever entered this room had socks. Just that could happen. And then it would, and of course we'd know about it, we'd expect it, blah blah blah. And it would have to count as a law of nature in the thing. Okay? It's a really unsatisfactory view. Yeah.
So the laws are really large, they're supposed to be very basic, so you can use a lot of other ones.
Yeah.
So not every regularity.
That's it. Hume didn't worry about that. Some of Hume's followers tried to do that.
They said, no, it's regularities that are very central to our whole system of beliefs. That's a good reply. The trouble with all of those views, all anyone in the Humean group, is that they make laws subjective. Because what might be in your cluster of beliefs, what's central to your cluster, might be quite different from what's central to his cluster. And then it turns out that laws are relative to the believer. And that just doesn't satisfy our instinctive intuition that there's something very objective about the laws. Hard to figure out what they are. Whatever they are, they're not relative to me, relative to you, and so on. Now, there's a much nicer view than a lot of people hold. It's called the Ramsey-Lewis view, and it's a little more like the view you just suggested. So this view says, I don't know what the facts are. These are like facts, happenings in space-time, okay? But you imagine all the facts that there are, and then you try to set up an axiom system that would derive, not necessarily all of them, but would systematize those facts in some way. And the axiomatization that you're after is the one that's maximally strong and simple at the same time. So, I mean, the strongest one just gets everything, but it's so unwieldy that you don't want that. And so you put some sort of simplicity constraints on it and pare it down. And then the law becomes the stuff that's pretty basic and the logical consequences of the basic stuff. So it would actually do just the trouble with the view, and it's a hell of a lot more sophisticated than the Hume and the variations of the Hume. The trouble, I think, with the view is the notions of maximally strong and simple. It may not be unique. It may not be a unique maximally strong and simple axiomatization of the entire history of the universe. And simplicity itself is, it may in fact be completely subjective. Yeah, these are good objections to this view.
But nothing in the beginning of the law actually requires convenience.
No, but the view asserts that it's got to be neat. So, I mean,
it has to be neat.
Oh, excuse me. Well, intuitively, because here's a basic intuition that I doubt you want to give up, and that is, whatever the laws are, there's something there for us all to discover. There's not two sets of laws operating. But if the axiomatization were not matched, weren't unique, suppose there's two axiomatizations that are equally simple, and equally strong. And in one of them, all the people in this room are wearing socks. Turns out to be a law of nature. But in the other one, it's not a law of nature. That would be an unsatisfactory situation. Right? I think you want to do this.
That's not
true. Yeah. But it's a philosophical question that you guys. Okay. Now, what's the right view? Okay. There's a view that's been trying to answer these problems of objectivity and so on, and accidental generalizations. Some people have proposed the following, which I think is on the right track. But you have to be a Platonist about this. Okay? So you say that laws are not regularities. What laws are relations among properties. The relations among abstract entities. And I'll go back to my rating example. Okay? What the law is some sort of relation between the property of being a raven and the property of being colored black. See, ravenhood and blackness are related, okay, as properties. So you're working, you're outside the physical world, but you're working at this level of high generality, and you're dealing just with properties, not with objects. And there's a relation among these properties. And that relation, sometimes called a relation of necessitation, what that does is entail the regularity. So if raven good is related appropriately to blackness, then it will be the case that you get a regularity, all ravens are black. Okay? But it doesn't go the other way. This is the law. The regularity is a consequence. Now notice that you can have regularities, like all the people in this room are wearing socks, but it's not a law because there's no thing up here, you know, between people in the room and socks. The appropriate relation up there. Okay? I mean, but the crucial thing here is that what laws are about is abstract entities. They're about properties, they're about universals. Okay? You can see now where I'm going, right? Okay, let me get to the let me get to the last thing and then sorry, what was your question?
Why is the best?
Because this view can explain the difference between all ravens are black being a genuine law and all the people in this room have socks on is an accidental generalization.
But then the law is somehow given more in the principles that said that the law comes from regularities.
Yeah.
It's a law is an organizational principle that we use. While the person that you're saying has the law in some very abstract way.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah. A law is not an organizational principle. You might say something like that. Ma, especially Ma. This view is very, very anti-Ma, anti-view.
Isn't it true that the law is a law that is observed?
No. You know, there might be all kinds of laws that are never observed. On this view, there might even be laws where there's no instantiation of it. Oh, you do it empirically. I mean, you still discover the law. Look at that. Discovering the law is probably by noticing a regularity. And then you say, gosh, this is probably not an accident. It's probably a genuine law. In which case, there must be some relation among the properties that links them. Okay? Sure, it's fallible. It's
absolute.
How are we doing? Let me get to the last. This is the last one.
Because you're finding it for us, we're
fine. Oh, I'm fine. But all right. Let me just put it all together. Okay. So this is the main thing. That some, not all, a small number of thought experiments actually provide the conditions for seeing laws of nature, kind of intellectual grasp of a law of nature. In other words. You know, something like the Galileo thought experiment on falling bodies gives you a priori knowledge of nature. How? Well, because we know from the math figures and things that human agents are capable of grasping abstract entities, at least in the math case. So there should be nothing to prohibit them from grasping other kinds of abstract entities, namely the ones involved in the laws. When might you do that? When might you actually grasp the relations themselves as opposed to going empirically through the regularity, conjecturing the law? You might actually do that in very rare cases with an appropriate thought experiment. That's how the three bits fit together. Okay? Each one, maybe, other than philosophy in itself, comes together a little, well, like a stool. Yeah? Three-legged stool rather than one or two-legged stool. Okay, that's the main point. Okay, now it's a free-for-all. Yeah,
well, that's great. I will change it.
Yeah, are
you happy? Can you have a light up a little bit? And
yeah.
And are you happy to comment, people? Or
yeah, I can do that.
I'll make sure that nobody's left out.
Okay.
So physics itself is so heavily sitting on top of that, that boundary between the two is, I would say, invisible.
Oh, yeah. I think they're completely different things. So where are we going? This is right at the start.
Let's just, okay, say you accept this.
Yeah.
Math itself sits on a Plotkin's question.
Yeah.
So then you say physics itself is sitting on Plotkin's question.
Yeah, that's right. That chain of reasoning gives you a kind of Platonism in physics. In an even simpler way than I might be for. But I still believe for a minute that math and physics are the same thing. I think they're wildly.
Okay. And also the other thing I was thinking, in terms of laws, one of the things you have to accept when you design a law is that it's not just for you. It's for everyone. So if you're going around to everyone and you get 50% of people completely incapable of coming to